I'm Paul Kennedy, and this is Ideas. Tonight's program is called You Are, Therefore I Am. It's the holy trinity of New Age spirituality, body, mind, and spirit. For people who've rejected traditional religion, and there are many of them, this idea of body, mind, and spirit becomes the guiding principle, pointing to a life that's more meaningful. At least that's the idea. Tonight, two spiritual teachers who want us to think about this a little more carefully. Alan Clements and Satish Kumar are both former monks, and both warn that a focus on spirituality should never come at the expense of other concerns, like the truth of science, for example, or caring for those who are less fortunate. First, Satish Kumar. In Satish Kumar's view, the trinity of body, mind, and spirit is dangerously self-centered, completely ignoring the ideas of service and social justice. Kumar has been called the sage of the deep ecology movement and one of our most important teachers. He's a former Jain monk, and he's now the editor of Resurgence, an international magazine promoting peace, justice, sustainability, and spirituality. Here is Satish Kumar in conversation with the host of Tapestry, Mary Hines.
The current issue of your magazine, Resurgence, is a special issue on science and spirituality. And you have an intriguing take on this. You say each one is incomplete without the other. How do you see that?
Yes. Without spirituality, science is incomplete. And without science, spirituality is incomplete. For example, if you have spirituality without thoughtful, cautious, rational thinking, then very quickly spirituality can turn into a very fundamentalist, dogmatic, narrow-thinking religion. Then we lose that kind of compassionate, open, inclusive approach.
But think of some of the great mystics. Think of Rumi in a trance or some of the whirling dervishes. That would not be called rational.
I think they had also rational side to them.
Do you think?
Yes, they did. Because rationality is not just measurement. Rationality is also logical thinking. For example, if you take the Buddha, his religion and his approach and his teachings are very rational. They fit in with everyday life as we live. They fit in with common sense as well as deep experience.
It was almost empirical. It was try this for yourself. If it works, yes, then adopt it
as
your code.
And Buddha said very clearly, don't take anything from me just because I say it.
Yes.
Just because a master tells you, or a teacher tells you, a scripture tells you, you try it, experiment it. So Buddha was a very experimentalist. So I would say, without that kind of approach, a scientific approach, what I would call, spirituality can become dogmatic, fundamentalist, and oppressive. Rather than liberating, it can become imprisoning. It can become conditioning your mind. And if you take somebody like Krishnamurti, who was a great Indian spiritual person, he always talked about this fact that religions without a scientific approach have become very narrow and so single-minded. I have the truth, and this is the truth because I have received it from my teachers or from my scriptures, and there's no other truth.
And yet we see so much of that in the world today. How do you keep so many of your editorials, so much of what I read of your thinking is so optimistic? How do you keep that optimism in the face of this kind of attitude, my way is the truth and everybody else is damned?
But that is why I say we bring in scientific approach. We bring in resurgence people like Fritz of Capra, like David Bohm, people who are deeply spiritual and yet have a very rational and very experimental mind. And that way we are able to say that there is no one truth. There are truths. And many people experience those truths in many different ways. Therefore, believing that there's only one way to do something and everybody has to follow that way can lead to an unscientific, dogmatic path.
What about the flip side of this equation? Why does science need spirituality? Why would it be seen to be incomplete without spirituality?
If you have science without spirituality, that it can also become oppressive, and it can lead to with technology without any ethics, without any morals, without any sort of ecological values, without any reverence, without any respect, because only science which you are pursuing is science which you can do and you can find and you can experiment. Wherever it leads is not your concern. Well, if you have a spirituality in the center of your science, then morals and ethics and human values and ecological values and what this science and this technology will do to our future generations, what it will do to the humanity in general, what it will do to our animal kingdom and plant kingdom and the air and earth and fire and water and what they will pollute and not pollute and the waste and all that, all those values come into play when you have science keeping spirituality in its center. So science needs spirituality as much as spirituality needs science.
We're at an interesting point now in history if we think of spirituality. You look at the bestseller lists, so it's laden with books on spirituality. People are thinking about it, people are talking about it. But you have a very sobering thought about this, that all of this talk about body, mind, and spirit is tremendously self-centered. It doesn't take us out into the world, into justice, into service.
That's right. That's right. Because when spirituality, without scientific understanding, is practiced, it becomes very narrow, self-serving, and you are self-obsessed. You think, my mind, my body, my spirit, I want to be happy, I. And that is not spirituality. You have to melt away your ego to be spiritual. You have to move away from I to we, and from me to us. And that we and us is not just the whole of humanity. I always say we need three dimensions together. We need soil, we need soul, we need society. Soil is environment, ecology, natural world, earth, air, fire, water, all plants, all animals, they are all represented in soil. Soil is source of life. If your spirituality does not include soil in the equation, then your spirituality is very self-seeking and very narrow. And therefore, our relationship, a reverential relationship with the natural world, with the soil and the earth, is an integral part of a spiritual path.
So, and I'm going to take you back to this trinity of yours in a minute, the soil, soul, and society, because I think it's very intriguing. But I want to take you back to a minute to the more New Age approach that we see around us, so prevalent, the body, mind, and spirit. Is that a worthless spirituality, do you think? Is that worse than no spirituality at all because it is so self-centered?
I would say that it is dangerous. More than worthless, it is dangerous, because you are calling it spirituality, but it is actually a spiritual materialism. It is very materialistic. When you are thinking just my body, my mind, my spirit, you are following a path of separational worldview and a separational attitude rather than relational. Spirituality connects with all. Spirituality comes from aspirare, which is breathing, which is connected with air. Spirit is connected with air. And air is a unifying force. There is no boundary, no borders, no national boundaries. It's not American air or Canadian air or European air or African air. Air permeates throughout the universe. So spirituality is all inclusive. The moment you say this is American air, this is American spirituality, it's a Canadian spirituality, it's a my spirituality, the moment you narrow it down, it becomes materialism. It becomes no longer spirituality.
Is this what gets us into society? The third of your triad? Soul, and society?
Yeah. So when you are connecting with the soil and with the natural world, then you are developing a soulful relationship. So I would say from soil, you move to soul. And in that sphere, if it is in the right context of the natural world and our relationship with the universe in a reverential way, then your mind, body, spirit falls in right place. And there you can take care of your own personal being. And in order to develop that, you need to go into the natural world. You have to go for walking, in solitude, in meditation, in doing yoga, in making your personal life such that it is sort of compatible with the natural world. And when you have these two together, then you can move into the social aspect.
But let me stop you on soul for a minute, because that's a word we hear tossed about almost with abandon. What does it mean? What does soul mean to you?
Soul is a quality of life, quality of everything. So water, what you see is water, but the quality of water is the soul of water. So meaning, so for example, you and I are sitting in front of each other. There's a relationship between us two. That is a soul quality. We develop friendship. There's a soul quality. We develop compassion for each other. We want to share with each other. We want to give something to each other. That is a feeling. That there's a soul quality. So each and everything has that soulfulness. And so when we move from quantity, which is more, you can say, matter, to quality, which is soul, and you need both. You need quantity and quality. You need matter and soul. What you can see, what you can touch, what you can measure, what you can analyze is matter. What you can feel, what you can taste, what you can appreciate in a qualitative way, that is soul quality. So soul is not a solid object. It is a qualitative word.
I read part of an interview the other day with the spiritual teacher Ram Dass, and it was very funny. Someone asked him, where are we in history, in humanity? Is this the long-awaited awakening of humanity, or is it Armageddon? I look around, I can't tell. And Ram Dass thinks about this, and he says, well, if it's the awakening of our species, here's what I need to do. I need to clear all this chatter in my mind, open my heart, and there you go. On the other hand, if it's Armageddon, well, let's see. I'll want to clear all this chatter in my mind and open my heart. So you know what? I don't care which one it is. Do you see humanity as being poised for either one of those extremes, a great awakening or a great ending?
There is no clear cut, black and white distinction between crisis and opportunity. They are two sides of the same coin. So we are going through a great crisis. You can call it Armageddon, but that's too hard and too extreme word. But I would say we are at the moment, as a humanity, going through a number of crises. We are going through a spiritual crisis. We are going through a crisis of peace and war. We are going through an ecological crisis. So we are going through crises because the current worldview is based on Cartesian, dualistic relationship. So we think that we can control others. We can control natural world. We can control other people. We can control markets. So this control paradigm is dominating. But on the other hand, at the same time, there is a tremendous hunger and thirst for relationships, for friendship, for love, for peace, for quiet, for tranquility, for spirituality. So this is a kind of struggle, and it's an eternal struggle. At any time in the history of humanity, we have always been through this struggle. So there is no particular moment when you can say now one is absolutely winning over the other. So I am an optimist, and I think that these crises which we are faced today are not going to remain as they are now. They will change, and some sort of spiritual awakening, maybe greater awakening, some sort of Buddhahood is bound to come, because human spirit is more resilient than all the kind of crises that we are faced. So I'm optimist, and I don't think we need to worry too much, and we need to seek a way which will lead to a better future for our children and grandchildren and seven generations to come. So we need to always be alert and aware. At the moment, we are being driven by the forces of commercialism, forces of materialism, forces of advertising, and so on. At the moment, we are being intoxicated.
You mentioned a minute ago Cartesian thought, which pits one against the other, and yeah. It seems to me that you've taken a bit of a swipe at the famous Descartes dictum, "I think, therefore I am," in your new book. Give us your version of,
that's
of
right.
what
that's
that dictum should mean. What's your title?
The title of my book is "You Are, Therefore I Am." And "you" here is in Martin Buber's meaning of the word, which is I-thou relationship. So everything has life. I'm an animist. I believe that everything has a kind of sacred nature, and therefore our relationship with everything, including this microphone and this chair, should be a relationship with the sacred in mind. And so I say, thank you, microphone, for helping me to communicate my words and my thoughts. And I say, thank you, this chair. You are holding me in comfort where I can sit. So I have a sort of I-thou relationship. And this idea that I can exist in my mind, in my thought, and mind over matter, this dualistic thinking, which Descartes was the kind of prominent exponent, I feel that this is what has led us to the crisis which we were talking about, the ecological crisis, the spiritual crisis, the social crisis. In order to redirect our attention, we need to have a new world view, which is not a world view of isolation, separation, dualism. We need a world view of relationship, world view of participation rather than control. And in order to get that world view, we need to have new language. And that language is, you are, therefore I am. We depend on each other. I cannot exist without my parents. I cannot exist without my culture, my ancestors, my teachers. And the food I eat, the air I breathe, the water I drink, the warmth I get from the sun. So we are totally dependent on each other. America created a declaration of independence. I am creating a declaration of dependence.
But we're also in a time of great fear, personal fear, fear for security. Are we safe? Is everything going to be okay? Does that sort of fear not push us in the opposite direction? Not towards one another, but towards just sort of bundling in and making sure I'm okay.
But we have to ask where this fear is coming from before we go further in resolving our fear. We have to ask why I have this fear. I have fear because I think I am myself. I am alone. I have to look after myself. This separational worldview of Descartes, that I think, therefore I am, is the cause of fear. Now, when you say, you are, therefore I am, it means that I don't have my personal interest in conflict with your interest. American national interests are not in conflict with Iraqi national interests. Indian national interests are not in conflict with Pakistani national interests. Jewish national interests are not in conflict with Palestinian national interests, because one is because of the other. And that kind of relationship, symbiotic relationship, is what creates the world. If we have this world view, there will be no cause for fear. The kind of institutionalized fear that we have today will melt away, disappear, because we will be building our society rooted in the foundations of trust.
But does the fear itself not stand against that sort of utopian society coming about?
No, I would say fear, yes, it does. But the root of fear is our concept, our belief, our mindset that we have to stand alone ourselves and protect myself first. Then I will do something else. So this self-oriented and self-seeking, this is another kind of mind-body-spirit phenomena. This is self obsessed society we have, and that self goes bigger and bigger and bigger. I become my town and my city and my country, whatever, my market or my whatever it is, my religion. So this my against yours, I versus the other, this conflict, and the conflicts exist in the world. We have to see the world in relationship terms. Then I think fear will be reduced, and we will have more trust, and we will create a better world.
Some of the most passionate mail we get at this program, and this is a program about spirituality and faith and the search for meaning, so we get a lot of really thought-provoking letters, and some of the most thought-provoking correspondence we have comes from atheists. And there was a very eloquent writer last week who said, of course this is a wondrous universe we live in. Of course it's a place of splendor and unimaginable. It's beyond what we can conceive of. I just don't think humans should invent a god to explain it. It's full of wonder without any kind of deity or creator. Yeah. How would you respond to that?
I would respond to that this I and God as two separate entities is also part of the Cartesian way of thinking. Even though not necessarily Descartes himself, but Cartesian way of dualistic thinking, that God somewhere away creating the world, controlling the world, managing the world, I am here as a victim. My attitude of God and humanity and nature is also non-dualistic. God is within us, imminent, present. So when the flower is blossoming, God is blossoming. When the fruit is feeding the world, God is feeding the world. God is everywhere within us. Each and every human soul, each and every leaf on the tree, each and every grass, butterfly, everything is a dance of Shiva. It's a dance of God. So God is not something separate. So if you present this non-dualistic view to this your atheist correspondent, he will realize, or she will realize, that God is not an external force. All energy, all kind of life force is imbibed with God. So that's why we say reverential ecology is a divine ecology, and we have a kind of understanding that everything is sacred. Relationship is sacred, the rivers are sacred, life is sacred, animals are sacred, trees are sacred. And so in that sense of the sacred gives us a new world view where dualism of God and humanity disappears.
You're listening to Satish Kumar in conversation with the host of Tapestry, Mary Hines. Kumar is a former Jain monk who is now the editor of Resurgence, an international magazine promoting peace, justice, sustainability, and spirituality. This is Ideas on CBC Radio 1. Here's Mary Hines.
This is one of the hallmarks of your work, Satish, because you you see the sacred in areas that are generally thought to be not at all sacred. And one of them is the economy. You write a great deal. You've done a lot of work about the economy. And someone in the current issue of Resurgence says, you know, there aren't many issues in politics that are truly unmentionable. Well, here's the biggest one. Economic growth. Does it deliver what it was supposed to? For example, make us all happier. Do you think it does?
It doesn't. Because economy is no longer economy. We have confused money and wealth. Money is not wealth. Wealth is our friendship, good communities, good relationships, clean air, clean water, good quality of soil, wonderful forests, the natural world and resources. That is true wealth. And we think that if we can have money, $10 million in my bank account or whatever, then I'm wealthy. So wealth and money is confused. And so now we are looking for our satisfaction, for our fulfillment in money, in external economic growth. The more I have, better I will be. But that is like churning sand to get butter. And however much I'm churning and churning and working harder and harder. I get up 8 in the morning. I start 8:30 in the morning to work, and I work until 9 in the evening or 10 in the evening, and still I have not achieved what I set out to achieve. So this idea to achieve, this outcome, the success, the results, that is the economy that we are sort of burdened by. So now what we need to do is bring economy in its place and imbibe economy also with a sense of the sacred. Then economy can become a good tool for our work. And then we need also to bring arts, culture, aesthetics. Those are the qualities. So instead of seeking economic success, we need to seek human fulfillment. And fulfillment is something which grows from inside, whereas economic success and economic growth is something external.
But you've written something very provocative on this topic. You've said the problem is not poverty. The problem is affluence. We don't need to alleviate poverty. We need to alleviate affluence. Why do you say that?
I say this because, first of all, the word poverty itself has been hijacked. In Christian terminology, you take a vow of poverty. It does not mean misery, hunger, starvation. It means voluntary acceptance of limits. It means simplicity of life. It means taking more time for finer things of life, like arts and culture and music and imagination and poetry and spirituality and friendship, rather than just money, money, money. So poverty word needs to be reclaimed. And if you take in that proper sense of the word, the proper meaning of poverty, then poverty is the solution. And wealth and economy and money is the problem. Who pollutes the world? People who have money pollute the world. Who create this kind of scarcity of oil, of other resources? It's the wealthy who create scarcity. So the culprits of ecological crisis and social crisis and gap between rich and poor, all these are created by the wealthy and privileged. So the real problem is affluence. Real problem is opulence. And the solution is to go back to voluntary simplicity in true sense of the word, poverty. We should embrace poverty. We should celebrate poverty in its true meaning. And we should not seek wealth, and we should not show off our wealth.
But is there a danger in portraying the poor as somehow better or more noble, and the wealthy as being the cause of all the ills of the world? Is there a naivete in the kind
no,
of thinking
that
says
it is the truth?
The poor are nobler because they are poor.
No, it is the truth. Poor are nobler.
Maybe they don't want to be poor.
No. We have enforced the kind of poverty you are talking about, the misery and starvation. But you know, great teachers such as the Buddha, he was rich, He was wealthy. He was a prince. He had palaces. He had horses. He had elephants. He had servants. He had jewelry. He had precious stones. And yet he gave up to accept the noble path of poverty and took a begging bowl. St. Francis, he was a merchant. He was a wealthy man. He gave up that opulence and affluence, and he took up the noble path of poverty. So I urge you that if we want a new way of life, which is more fulfilling and more satisfying and more sort of relationship-based, then we have to restore the meaning of poverty and see poverty as a noble way of living, rather than this endless seeking of more money, big houses, big cars, more gadgets, more machinery, and that is destroying our soul, that is destroying our society. So poverty is the solution for our time, and that is a spiritual path that we have to follow.
This brings us to a column that really struck me in Resurgence a while back. The headline was, "It is worth doing nothing." And the point was, you must rest. This was by a contributor. This wasn't one of your columns, but I'd like to get your take on this. The idea was, the world is sick with exhaustion, and this is soul-destroying. And perhaps, worst of all, we are adapting to it. This state of perpetual fatigue is beginning to feel like the norm. Is that your view as well?
Yes, it is my view. You know, we have underrated and underestimated the importance of sleep. There was an emperor of Persia who had a teacher, Sufi teacher. The emperor asked the teacher, "Tell me, what is the best thing to do for me?" The Sufi teacher says, "My lord, sleep as long as you can." The emperor said, "What? Sleep? I have so much work to do. I have justice to perform, ambassadors to meet, laws to make. I have no time to sleep." Say, "My lord, longer you sleep, less you will exploit, less you will destroy, less you will damage." We are all nowadays, particularly Canada and America, United States and European countries, Japan, these sort of industrial powers, they are the emperors of our time. And more they work, more they destroy. They drive cars, they use computers, they use electricity, more you do. So I would say, people in Canada, my listeners, people in the United States, people in European industrial powers, take your time to sleep. Give more time to rest. And when we are able to rest fully, our action, whatever they come, will be more imaginative, more creative, more beautiful. At the moment, we have destroyed beauty. We have destroyed aesthetics in our rush for more work, more work, more work. And if industrial powers are truly wealthy, then prove it by saying, "We have enough wealth in our countries. We don't need to work so hard." Make your week 25 hours working week. That'll be my limit.
You don't do this, do you?
I do less even. I do less. I don't work more than 2-3 days a week. I do gardening and I sleep a lot. Every day in the afternoon, I take a nap. And I take rest. I go for walking. I love walking. As you know, I walked around the world. But
yes,
even now,
on a peace crusade.
On a peace march, a peace walk. So when you are in nature, you are nourished. And when you have time, you are nourished. And that is greater and true wealth than all the wealth you can earn by earning $50,000 or $100,000. And then you are still exhausted and tired. What is good of having $100,000 but no time for your friends and for your children, for your family? So I would say, yes, work less, earn less, be more. Have less, be more. That is old spiritual wisdom which we have to rediscover for our time.
I wasn't hosting this program the last time you visited us to talk, but I was keenly listening at home to the interview with you. And you talked a fair bit about your early years and some of your history, and there was one question about that I've always been intrigued by. You were a monk, a Jain monk, as a young boy, and it was reading Gandhi's autobiography that moved you out of the monastery, that changed your view of where you should be. How does it happen that Gandhi's thought moves you away from a spiritual community?
I was 18 years old at that time, and I was not supposed to have been reading Mahatma Gandhi's autobiography, not being a religious text. But someone gave it to me and said, you will enjoy it, there are some nice things in it, spiritual things in it. And when I read it, what Mahatma Gandhi was putting out in this book, the message that spirituality is for the saints, and you have to go and live in a cave and leave the world, forsake the world. What we need to do, Mahatma Gandhi said in his book, what we need to do is to bring spirituality, practice of truth, practice of nonviolence, practice of compassion, equanimity, equity, all these spiritual values into everyday life. Your agriculture, your business, your industry, your politics, they all should be made spiritual. So forsaking the world and leaving the world behind you is not the answer. When I read this, I was totally unsettled. I was shaken. I said, wow, I am doing just the opposite. I think the world is no good. So how to transform the world? By doing everyday ordinary activity with a new worldview, a new consciousness, a new perspective. Then ordinary activity can be transformed into extraordinary activity. So Mahatma Gandhi was spinning the spinning wheel, cleaning the toilets, sweeping the floor, cooking the food, and making politics, and writing books. All that attracted me. So I decided to escape from the monastery one night after midnight and find a sanctuary in a Gandhian ashram, so that spirituality and the world, as we started our discussion with spirituality and science, spirituality and material world have to be brought together. The separation of matter and mind, separation of spirit and the world, is artificial separation. This separation is only in our thinking and mind. There is no real separation. Meaning and matter, meaning and the words, they are together, and we have to see them together.
Satish Kumar, it is such a pleasure to talk to you and to listen to you. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Satish Kumar is the editor of Resurgence magazine, which is devoted to peace, justice, sustainability, and spirituality. He lives in Devon, England. I'm Paul Kennedy, and this is Ideas on CBC Radio 1. A long time ago, a young man named Alan Clements thought he'd like to be a lawyer, but he was looking for something more in life, so he embarked on a path that would take him to Burma, to Buddhism. Alan Clements became a Buddhist monk. But the path had a few more twists in store for him. Alan would go on to work with Aung San Suu Kyi, Burma's Nobel Peace Laureate, and what he saw in Burma would change him profoundly. He ended up renouncing Buddhism and every other ism. He's written a book called Instinct for Freedom, Finding Liberation Through Living. Today, Alan calls himself Spiritually Incorrect, the name of a one-man show he's performed around the world. Home these days is in Vancouver. Here's Alan Clements in conversation with the host of Tapestry, Mary Hines.
You know, up until now, the world has known you as a pretty serious man. You were a monk, you were a scholar of Buddhism, you've written books. Now you're giving one-man shows called Spiritually Incorrect, and you're making fun of religion. What happened to you?
I left the monastery way back in the mid-80s, and for the life of me, I don't know what happened. I mean, there was a tremendous shift in consciousness. But at the same time, Mary, I think I became indoctrinated within my own need for dogma. And so I would say I became a bit of a Pentecostal Buddhist.
What an image.
A Jerry Falwell of classical Buddhist meditation. And I was nifty at it. I was good at it. And so subsequently, I had the tragic, beautiful fortune to witness two genocides. It's not easy to use those two words together. Tragic in the obvious sense of seeing people murdered is not an easy thing to get used to, much less being the victims of such a horror as I witnessed in Burma and then later on in the former Yugoslavia. The beauty of it was that it cracked my heart open, Mary, and as a result of that, I began to see my own indoctrination, my own coma of conformity. I was a very spiritually correct Buddhist, and when you enter these very tragic, profound domains of the unexplainable mystery of the human heart, you begin to see, as I saw in Bosnia and Burma, what is being done in the name of. And I didn't want to fall victim to this cult anymore, so I broke out of my coma, and the only way that I could really do it, I felt, was trying to introduce some humor and some satire and some wit and some basic play into an otherwise very complicated, difficult thing called religion.
Well, there are not many places where religion and humor intersect, and I must say your show really, you bring both of them together. There's a point in your book, a scene in your book, I believe also in your show, and it is a merciless look at a couple of American spiritual seekers in India. Do you remember these folks?
Unfortunately, I do. They're everywhere, all over Vancouver and Toronto and San Francisco and Los Angeles.
Give me a bit of that spiel as you do it on stage. Set the scene for our listeners. Who were these people?
How to set the stage? They're a couple of spiritually correct spiritual types from San Francisco, and this must have been in the late 80s. It's probably not too different than the present 2003. They had the classic look, you know, white clothing, beards, mala beads. They had the picture of their guru or somebody around their neck. And they were looking at me with this, I guess you would call it, I'm in the moment kind of stare. And
were you in robes at the time?
I was a monk at the time, bald-headed, barefoot, wearing orange robes. I'm sure I was estranged to them as they were estranged to me. We were in Calcutta in the very poor zone of the city near Mother Teresa's Center for the Deaf and Dying, and they had spotted me, I think, as a Westerner and asked me this question: how do you get to Mother Teresa's Center? We want to go there and visit. And I don't know what it is. I'm allergic to spiritual types. I'm even allergic to my own spirituality. I don't like it. There's something about the pretense of being somehow special that just somehow annoys me. They began to tell me their entire history, how they had been in India for a long time. They left the West. They had practiced meditation. They had done Gestalt therapy. They had done Primal Scream. They had done psychotherapy with different healers. Nothing worked. And please, you as a Buddhist monk, you must be able to shine the light on us. You must know the answers. And I really had nothing to say. And all they wanted to know was, how do we find the truth? And eventually...
Well, that's all. That's all they wanted.
That's all. So they began to do what I think they did best, which was to assert their neurosis on the scene, as I was doing, and they began to complain about their relationship not being fulfilling, and he began to talk about this, and all of a sudden the beggar came up around us and was demanding, please, just a few pennies, just a few pennies. You're rich, I'm poor, just a few pennies, please. And all of a sudden this guy looked at him and says, no, get out of here. And it was a real kind of Fellini-esque Twilight Zone gestalt where they just looked at him and says, please, get out of here. We don't want to give you anything. And they looked at me. We're really sorry that we've inconvenienced you in your meditation. Please, would you just tell us the directions to Mother Teresa's Center for the Deaf and the Dying, and we'll be on our way?
Mm.
And there you go, how easy it is to seek the truth and miss it right in front of our eyes.
But, you know, Alan, the spiritual search can certainly become a caricature for some people. A lot of others are really sincere. They're looking for meaning. They are looking for a connection to something greater, to the divine. Do you think they're wrong to be on that search?
No, I think it's beautiful. I'm a real believer that in the sanctity of existence, to be somewhat sincere at the moment. I really do believe in the sanctity of existence. And But so often in the pursuit of liberation, one becomes the very image of what they're trying to break out of. I mean, how often I find people, I've seen in my own self, I mean, just look around the world today, how religion has become commodified and solidified into a statue of its own self-image.
I heard an interview with you this summer on Australian radio, and you talked about the practice of watching your breath for 10 years, in and out, in and out.
I thought you'd bring that up.
9 billion times. And in the end, the great insight was, and I mean, you say something like, hey, dude, you can breathe.
Well,
is that what you were left with?
No, that was the beginning insight. That took me 10 years. don't underestimate my enlightenment now, Mary.
Oh, sorry, Alan.
No, for 10 years I sat there. I mean, literally the instruction is to be present and watch the nature of your mind, like clouds in the sky, or thoughts come and go like birds passing through the air. And in the absence of anything more predominant, as you were saying, was to watch your breath. A very simple instruction, but it's not a very easy thing to do. And I would encourage listeners to sit down for 5 minutes and just simply focus an awareness on the sensation of yourself breathing. It's not an easy thing. So I got so compelled by this activity that for 20 hours a day, year after year, I sat and walked and watched my breath. And for the life of me, Mary, I did not understand what the big deal was until eventually it dawned on me, as you said, well, what is the insight of watching your breath? It's that alone, that you are breathing. And it took a long time that watching your breath will lead to the insight of the frailty of the human experience, our own mortality. And that became such a precious understanding that when you realize that you're breathing, you realize that the breath is a privilege, that it could stop, and it will stop, as we all know, perhaps mid-sentence at some point, it all happens to all of us. And so with that recognition, it rendered me into a place of innocence and awe and wonderment that I had never known in my life. And so I signed up for the advanced program.
More watching, more breathing.
More watching. Another 10 years went by, and I'll say people, all the pleasurable days of months of watching your breath come and go for 20 years. And what was the final insight for me was that, well, now that you've established the fact that you're breathing and the sanctity of life, well, you get up off your butt and you do something remarkable with what a full breath affords you. And that became a very transformational distinction for me, of leaving eventually the meditative path behind as I once knew it, and beginning to empower what Desmond Tutu introduced me to as a concept in his own culture of South Africa was the concept of Ubuntu, which he describes as a person becomes human through their interaction with other humans, with other life. Life knows itself through life. In other words, he went on to say that with the quality of Ubuntu, when something denigrates the other person, you will feel it as something that denigrates you. And conversely, when something elevates another person with the emotion of Ubuntu present in one's heart, you'll feel it as something that elevates you. And so the higher form of meditation for me today is found in this concept of Ubuntu, a mutual discovery through human interaction. And I feel that we need to overcome sectarianism, nationalism, religion, and begin to see the common values, Mary, not a very original thought, the common values, the shared principles that perhaps all religions point to. And I think that is the challenge today of the true and authentic seeker, is to overcome our particular religion and find the commonality of what brings life into a higher order. And I've said one of the most politically incorrect things in the world.
What's that?
I hope it's acceptable, but I'll say it anyway. But I really feel that the greatest act of compassion that the Pope can do for the world is to renounce Catholicism and begin to empower the beauty of shared values. I really feel that the highest gift that the Dalai Lama can offer the world is to renounce Tibetan Buddhism and to really empower shared human values. I think the highest thing that all Muslims in the world can do is to denounce Islam and to find the common values. I feel that the highest thing that all Christians can do is to denounce Christianity and find the core essence. Love doesn't belong to a nation or a religion, nor does compassion. And the sooner that we find these shared values, I think we'll overcome the horrible gap that we're seeing in the world today between the rich and the poor, the Republicans against the Democrats, the Christian white against the fundamentalist Muslims, the Caucasian against the Asians, the male against the female, and begin to bridge these huge chasms and begin to empower the human spirit. The spirit is the religion of the 21st century. And what is that spirit?
Do you get discouraged when you look around and think of the state of this world of ours?
You know, Mary, I cry a lot. I'd say that's probably the most consistent emotion that I feel most of my time. I can tell a short story. I met the Dalai Lama many times, but back in 1989, the year he won the Nobel Peace Prize, I was invited to a conference that he was leading on Buddhism and psychotherapy, in which 3,000 people were there. And one person asked the Dalai Lama, "Sir, do you have an inspiration?" And of course, the Dalai Lama, the world over, is an inspiration to many, many millions of people, the embodiment of compassion and kindness. And he instantly, Mary, said, "Yes, I do have an inspiration." He said, "In my country of Tibet, there's a man there that goes by the name the Weeper." The Weeper, a person who cries all the time, he said. And people were taken aback. And he went on to explain that the Weeper was a man, wherever he walked, he frequently cried. He cried when he saw a child without shoes whose feet were cracked and bleeding, and he imagined that girl to be his own daughter. And he felt that young girl, and he cried in her eyes. He would walk and he would see an old man who was begging by the street, the Dalai Lama would say. And he imagined that old man to be his father. And rather than being able to give something to the old man, he stood there and cried. And equally, he said that when he saw a rich couple walk by in their fancy clothes, and the rich couple looked at the old monk and said, "Get out of here, old beggar. You're useless to society." And the old monk looked at them and cried, because he still saw in his own heart the haughtiness that he had and the pride, and he wasn't free of that. And he cried at his own arrogance. And the Dalai Lama looked at the audience and said, "This man's compassion wasn't very well developed, because all he could do was cry in the face of suffering. He really couldn't help out." And the audience was stunned, and the Dalai Lama concluded the story by saying, "But this man's compassion was much more developed than my own. This is why he's my mentor, my inspiration."
Hmm.
Now, if you take this story one step deeper, you know, crying all the time isn't your normal, well-adjusted spiritual Buddhist.
Oh, works for some of us, I must say.
You know, if you cried all the time, surely your husband, your spouse, your friends would send you into psychotherapy. And a year of tears, very likely you'd be on Prozac or Wellbutrin. 2 years, institutionalized. But the Weeper was the Dalai Lama's mentor. There's a lesson here. Be free, be real, be vulnerable, be unique.
It's terrific to be able to talk to you about this. Thank you very much.
A tremendous honor, Mary. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Alan Clements in conversation with the host of Tapestry, Mary Hines. He now lives in Vancouver, and he's the author of Instinct for Freedom, Finding Liberation Through Living, published by New World Library. Tapestry is heard every Sunday afternoon on CBC Radio 1. Tonight's program was produced by Susan Mahoney and Marika Mayer, with technical assistance by Dave Field. Associate producer and webmaster, Liz Nagy. You can get an audio copy of tonight's program for $18, including taxes and shipping. The number to call is 416-205-7367. You can also send a check or credit card information to Ideas Transcripts, Box 500, Station A, Toronto, M5W1E6. Our e-address is ideas@cbc.ca. The executive producer of Ideas is Bernie Lucht, and I'm Paul Kennedy. Please stay tuned now for the CBC Radio News, followed by the Arts Tonight.